dodges I ride in this wind.
They're criticized because they don't have specific demands. Why aren't they protesting against corporate personhood? Why aren't they calling for electoral reform? Because they understand the whole damn system is rotten.
The gold you have taken from somebody else. And as we go riding in the damp, foggy midnight, you snort my good pony. And
you're listening to episode 584 of Unwelcome Guests. Why Occupy? I'm Robin Upton, and the voice you just heard was that of Chris Hedges, our first speaker. 10 weeks since our first program on Occupy, I'm encouraged by how the movement is developing, even during this cold weather, and in an effort to promote the dialogue, both hours this week are dedicated to the occupiers. The speaker in our second hour will be Derek Jensen, and in our first, Chris Hedges. And this is from the International Scene Lecture Series, Chris Hedges speaking at Hofstra University. There is an introduction which I've skipped because most listeners will be quite familiar with the works of Chris Hedges. If you'd like to hear that or see this on video, you can do so by accessing this show's webpage, unwelcomeguest.net/584. I've kept just a little bit of the introduction to give you a flavor.
And I'll just end my introduction with the beginning of a recent column of his, because I think it's really a call to action. He begins it saying, "There are no excuses left. Either you join the revolt taking place on Wall Street and in the financial districts of other cities across the country, or you stand on the wrong side of history. Either you obstruct in the only form left to us, which is civil disobedience, the plundering by the criminal class on Wall Street and accelerated destruction of the ecosystem that sustains the human species, or become the passive enabler of monstrous evil. Either you taste, feel, and smell the intoxication of freedom and revolt, or sink into the miasma of despair and apathy. Either you are a rebel or a slave." Chris Hedges.
Thank you, and thanks for having me. I'm going to be down on Thursday in Washington, where we are also going to occupy a plaza. This has been planned for several months in coordination with the occupation in Wall Street. And I think that what we are seeing at this moment is unique and important and probably even monumental. And maybe our last chance. The corporate forces that have seized control of the political system, and here I would differ with you, I think going to a congressperson's office is an utter waste of time. The corporate forces that have seized control and have obliterated any kind of impediments or regulations have become a revolutionary force. In that sense, Karl Marx was completely right. Unfettered capitalism is a revolutionary force that has built within it its own inevitable self-annihilation, because it turns everything into a commodity that you exploit until exhaustion or collapse, so that human capital, human beings become commodities. That's, of course, what's happened to the American working class. There's been a Weimarization of the American working class. 47 million Americans who now live in poverty, 1 in 4 children who depend on food stamps to eat, 1 million Americans a year going into personal bankruptcy because they cannot pay their medical bills, and, of course, 45,000 Americans who die each year because they cannot get proper medical care. I come out of seminary in theological terms or in moral terms. The system that we have created permits corporations legally to hold sick children hostage while their parents bankrupt themselves trying to save their sons or daughters. That's the world we live in. 6 million people thrown from their homes because of foreclosures and bank repossessions, the numbers that's expected to climb to 10 million by next year. A real unemployment rate, as the Los Angeles Times has pointed out, that is not 9%. It is between 17 and 20%. These are depression level years of unemployment. When you count people who have either stopped looking for work or people who have poorly paid part-time jobs, and most part-time workers at places like Walmart work about 28 hours a week, but their wages put them below the poverty line. When you count all of these people, we are talking about roughly one in six American workers without adequate employment, and the corporate state has done absolutely nothing, even though they have plundered the U.S. Treasury, to ameliorate the suffering of the citizens. And that is because we have undergone a corporate coup, a coup d'etat in slow motion, as my friend John Ralston Saul has pointed out. Brilliant philosopher, by the way, and I highly recommend Voltaire's Bastards, which was a very important book for me, along with Unconscious Civilization. We've undergone a coup d'etat, and I spend a lot of time in my book, The Death of the Liberal Class, going back and looking at what happened. How did we end up like this? And I focus on World War I and Woodrow Wilson, who I think is a very dark figure in American history. On the eve of World War I, radical and populist movements were vying for control with the power elite. You had about three dozen socialist mayors, including in large cities like Schenectady and Milwaukee. The fourth most popular journal in the country was called Appeal to Reason. It was a socialist journal. The masses had a huge circulation. And what happened? As my one of the great writers who I admire immensely, Dwight MacDonald, wrote, what happened was the war was the rock on which these movements were broken. And if you go back to that period in American history, and Wilson had run for re-election on the slogan, he kept us out of the war, there was no support for getting involved in World War I. But the bankers, Wall Street, had lent tremendous sums of money to the British and the French. And with the collapse of the Eastern Front, there was a very real possibility that the German forces would be able to transfer their divisions away from containing what had been the forces of Tsarist Russia, and defeat the British and the French. And that meant that Wall Street would not be repaid. And so they pushed Wilson into the war. In order to sell the war to the American public, Wilson created the first system of modern mass propaganda, known as the Committee for Public Information, and popularly known as the Creel Commission. It was headed by a former muckraking journalist named George Creel. And not only did they have their own news division that produced pro-war stories, not only were all publications forced to adopt a pro-war stance, including Appeal to Reason, which actually acquiesced to this demand, although they shut them down after the war. The masses shut down publication. It had its own film division, out of Hollywood, which made movies like The Kaiser, The Butcher of Berlin, speakers bureaus, 45,000 public speakers fanning out across the country. But more importantly, it employed the understanding of mass psychology pioneered by figures like Le Bon, Trotter, and Sigmund Freud. And out of the Committee for Public Information comes Edward Bernays, the father of modern public relations, whose 1922 book, called Propaganda, which is worth reading, along with Lippmann's Public Opinion, became the blueprint for Goebbels and the Nazis. And they understood that people were not moved by fact or reason. They were moved by the manipulation of emotion, what Walter Lippmann called the manufacturing of consent. And if you read, I think, the leading sort of moral and intellectual voices of the time, Randolph Bourne, or Jane Addams, they both despair about how effective that propaganda was and how almost everyone, including the social critics and the intellectuals, were seduced by its appeal. And what happens after the war? The actual harsher techniques of control, the Sedition Act, and the Espionage Act are employed very rarely during the war because the propaganda is so effective. And what happens, and again I go back to MacDonald, is that we entered this psychosis of permanent war, the permanent war psychology, where the dreaded Hun, once the war was over, was instantly replaced with the dreaded Red. And it is a testament to the resilience of populist forces that even though Eugene Debs, the head of the Socialist Party, is thrown in prison by Wilson from a prison cell in 1920 with his name on the ballot, he still pulls a million votes. And it's actually after the war that they use the Sedition Act and the Espionage Act to wipe out as much of the remnants of these movements. These is what culminated with the Palmer raids. They shut down the masses. They shut down appeal to reason. They go after these radical movements like the Wobblies, where they take the figures of a radical anarchist labor union. There's a wonderful scene, and I'm going to end by talking about Wall Street, but this moment in the history of the Wobblies reminds me of Wall Street. When there are strikes in San Francisco, and so Wobbly supporters are all put on a ship to go down and support the striking workers, and they're greeted on the docks by San Francisco's finest, who start beating the shit out of them, and as they're whacking them, they say, "Where's your leader? Where's your leaders? Where are your leaders?" And all, the Wobblies go, "We're all leaders." And how many people have been, you don't have to raise your hand, but I hope some of you have been down to Wall Street, you know the undercover, NYPD has put in undercover cops. And the biggest tip-off that they're an undercover cop, aside from the fact that they look like a cop, is that they walk around going, "Who are the leaders? Where are the leaders?" And what's driving them crazy is that it's not a hierarchical organization. There are no leaders. It's ruled by consensus, which is cumbersome and time-consuming, but it makes them protean. They can't take out this person or that person and see the structure collapse. There was some cop down there the other day in a New York Yankees baseball cap running around telling everybody he was a student from Rollins College, even though he looked to be about 35. And they asked him for his ID, and he said, "Oh, yeah, I don't know." And he went up to one of the women and said, "So, who's running this?" And she goes, "I am." And he goes, "Oh." He said, "And what's your name?" And she goes, "God." So these movements, like the Wobblies, they really went after. They trumped up murder charges on Joe Hill out of Utah, ends up being executed. Big Bill Haywood, the leader of the Wobblies, has to flee to Moscow and spends the last 10 years of his life in exile. And that was a seminal moment in American history, because these movements, including the Communist Party, and remember, the Civil Rights Movement came out of the Communist Party. I mean, that has been utterly erased from American history. But all of the reason figures like Paul Robeson joined the Communist Party is because they didn't discriminate based on color. There were integrated sit-down attempts at lunch counters in the 30s by the Communist Party, which was in the historical memory of Byron Ruskin, who was sort of the intellectual force behind Martin Luther King. And one of the things the FBI kept trying to do is sever the relationship between Ruskin and King, because Ruskin understood the tactics that had been effective in the 30s that were transferred onto the Civil Rights Movement. So the power elite, essentially out of that war in the name of anti-communism, broke these movements. Now that became very important for this reason. Traditionally, the liberal class is your political center. Traditionally, the pillars of the liberal establishment are what make incremental or piecemeal reform possible. So that when there are serious injustices and grievances within a society, you have a press, you have a judiciary, you have labor unions, you have church groups that can speak with a kind of constrained or limited moral voice to recognize the legitimacy of that suffering. And when Conrad Black writes his biography of Roosevelt, he said that Roosevelt's greatest achievement during the Depression was that he saved capitalism. And I think that's right. That the role of the liberal class is to set the parameters. by which debate is possible. So, for instance, if you read the op-ed pages of the New York Times, liberal, quote-unquote, self-identified liberal critics of the war in Iraq, who were all cheerleaders for the war at the time, but who have questioned it now, never questioned the intention of a Cheney or a Bush or a Poole or a Wolfowitz. That to question the intentions of the power elite is to be expelled from the liberal class. And one of the sort of current examples of an expulsion from the liberal establishment is Bill McKibben, who's a good friend of mine. Bill has been down in front of Washington protesting the building of a pipeline from the tar sands in Alberta down to the Gulf of Mexico, was thrown in jail or was arrested. They let everyone else go. They kept McKibben in jail for 52 hours in a cell with no mattress, on a metal cot, just on a slab of metal. He was given a glass of water and a bologna sandwich three times a day. And when Bill asked, why? Why is everyone else being released and I'm being held? He said, because we have orders from up on top to keep you here. Well, you know where those orders came from. They came from the fossil fuel industry. They didn't come from... The Obama White House may have been the conduit, but they came from the large fossil fuel concerns that don't want voices like Bill McKibben heard. And so I was doing an interview a couple weeks ago with Leonard Lopate at WNYC. And I mentioned that Bill had been arrested the day before. And Lopate said, oh, what was he doing down there trying to make the world more green? As if it was a joke. Mm-hmm. And what they're doing to McKibben, who's, I think, one of the great moral voices in our country, is just what they did to my friend Ralph Nader. We are all going to look back on this period of history and rue the day we turned our back on Nader. It was the stupidest thing we ever did. Nobody understands corporations and how they work or has been fighting them longer than Nader. And what Nader was trying to do in 2008, and I not only supported him, but I wrote all of his major policy speeches for him. I was speaking to the University of Wisconsin. Somebody raised their hand and said, well, yes, he's great, but every time we listen to him, he's so boring. And I said, oh, geez, I thought he was just scintillating, because I wrote it. I thought it was just scintillating myself. Nader understood that we have to begin to build an obstructionist movement, which is what the protesters in Wall Street grasp. That if 5 to 10 million people had voted green or voted for Nader, we would begin to try and build a bulwark against the corporate Leviathan. And both of these parties, and Obama has amply proved that, serve the corporate state. Obama serves it as assiduously as did George W. Bush. If you look at all of the major issues, there is no difference. Whether it is imperial war, whether it is the refusal to respect basic rights of ordinary citizens, Obama has not restored habeas corpus. We still run offshore penal colonies where we openly torture other human beings, which of course is what we do in our supermax prisons. It's what they did to Bradley Manning. And you know why they did that to Manning? Have you ever thought, why did they do this to Manning? What? They wanted to turn him on Julian Assange, and they failed. They had all the information. They have his computers. There was no reason to impose this sort of psychological, and we know, I mean, it's scientific. I mean, the Stasi used it. They used to say the Gestapo breaks bones, the Stasi breaks souls. I mean, you know, we know what prolonged isolation does. We know what applying them with antidepressants. They know perfectly how to break you. And they were breaking him to try and make him, because what they want is Assange. They want his WikiLeaks. And, you know, for me, Bradley Manning is an American hero. And he didn't break. And let's be clear about what he leaked under the Geneva Convention. He leaked war crimes. He documented war crimes, which are committed on a daily basis in Iraq and Afghanistan. So we broke our populist movements, and they used, in the name of anti-communism, that ideology to disembowel the liberal establishment, including the universities, so that in the aftermath of World War II, with the McCarthy hearings, You have thousands of university professors who lose their jobs. Some of them may have had a dalliance with the Communist Party. So what? And they drove any kind of, or they certainly reduced any kind of critical thinking within the space of education significantly, so that it became marginal. I mean, you look at any economics department, I expect even the one at Hofstra, and the mantra of laissez-faire capitalism is about the only thing that can get you tenure. We destroy journalism. Figures like I.F. Stone becomes a pariah, probably our greatest investigative journalist. He can't even get a job at The Nation magazine. Social workers were decimated because traditionally the unions of social workers used to advocate on behalf of their clients, advocate on behalf of the poor. The State Department was purged. The consequences of this were tremendous because it instilled deep fear within liberal institutions, even within the ACLU. There were internal purges of figures who were soft on communism. It was the stick by which they destroyed the presidential aspirations of Henry Wallace, who ran in 1948. So that you end up in the 1960s with unions headed by figures like George Meany and Lane Kirkland, who support Nixon's war in Indochina and ridicule the anti-war protesters. The broad social vision that had been part of powerful populist radical unions like the old CIO and the Wobblies is now gone. And there's a reason we have the worst healthcare system in the industrialized world. It's because those forces, for instance, in Canada, which has universal healthcare, it was the unions who gave them universal healthcare. The unions struck, fought, and created healthcare for all citizens. And our unions withered and died. So they provided healthcare only for their own members and not for anyone else. And now, of course, that healthcare is being taken away. I'm very critical of the New Left in the 60s. And I, although I was a kid, my father was very involved in the civil rights movement. He was a Presbyterian minister. We lived in a farm town in upstate New York. This was at a time when Martin Luther King was probably one of the most hated men in America. He was a veteran of World War II. He'd been a sergeant in North Africa. Came back virtually a pacifist after the war. He was very involved in the anti-war movement. Indeed, he told me when I was about 12 years old that if the war was still being fought when I was 18 and I was drafted, he would go to prison with me. And to this day, I carry an image of sitting in a jail cell with my dad. To his eternal credit, he was also very vocal, and this was in the 1970s, for the gay rights movement. This was something that was very close to him personally. His youngest brother, my uncle, was gay and lived with his partner in Greenwich Village. My father had a particular sensitivity to the pain of being a gay man in America in the 50s and 60s. I think that's what finally got him blacklisted within the church, he making these public stances. I remember he had a very large church in Syracuse, New York then, and he publicly held an Easter service for gays and lesbians, and they crucified him for it. I was at Colgate University, which was an hour away from Syracuse, and when my dad found out that there was no gay and lesbian organization at Colgate, he drove the gay speakers to my campus. And I would sit around with small groups of students and gay activists and my dad, talking about respect and dignity and other ways of being. And I have to confess, I was probably one of the most committed heterosexuals at Colgate. And when I would go into the dining hall for breakfast, lunch, or dinner, the guy would take my card and check off the box and hand it back and go, "Faggot." So I made it my undergraduate mission to seduce his girlfriend. Coming out of the religious left, and this is Dorothy Day, the Christian anarchists, the Berrigans, and I just had lunch with Daniel Berrigan, Father Daniel Berrigan, who just turned 90. We were very distant from the new left, the hippie left, because of the hedonism, the drugs, the self-indulgence. We detested the Weather Underground because they used violence, and I think anybody who looks closely at what happened internally within both the Black Panthers and the Weather Underground understands the poison of violence. You end up replicating the behavior of the oppressor. Same kind of paranoia. The American Indian Movement had the same experience. The same kind of violence. And I think the difference is this, and it's one of the reasons why I'm so hopeful about Wall Street, is that when you come out of the religious left, there isn't a goal per se. There's a moral imperative to stand up against injustice. That's what you're called to do. You're called to do the good, or at least the good insofar as you can determine it, and then you have to let it go. That the Buddhists call it karma, that faith is the belief that it goes somewhere. But we can't allow the external forces around us to measure the quality of our life. Things may be worse by the time our lives are over. That does not invalidate what we've fought for. And certainly the most hopeful moment in the early part of the 20th century and the latter part of the 21st century and latter part of the 20th is what's happening right now. This is a movement which is absolutely beyond the comprehension of a hierarchical society. They're criticized because they don't have specific demands. Why aren't they protesting against corporate personhood? Why aren't they calling for electoral reform? Because they understand that the whole damn system is rotten. They understand that if we do not dismantle the power of these corporations and thwart the bizarre ideology that human behavior should conform to the dictates of the marketplace, which flies in the face of 3,000 years of economic history, we're finished. And there was a front page story on the New York Times about the forests dying in Montana. If our trees die, we're dead as a species. We either pretend global warming doesn't exist, or we pretend the equally self-deluded belief that we can all adapt to it. If we do not break our dependence on fossil fuel very, very quickly, it's over. And everybody in that plaza gets it. If we do not break the power of these corporations, we will live in a form of neo-feudalism. When they tell the American worker to be competitive on a global marketplace, they're telling them to be competitive with prison labor in China. If we don't break this and what has been instilled within us by a public relations industry, this inner compulsion towards consumption, if we don't break this, we're finished. And they get that. They know how little time we have left, and they know the monstrous evil they're up against. And issuing demands about electoral reform, which they also know, is an utter waste of time. Because the system is dead. It doesn't work. All of the traditional mechanisms by which reform were possible no longer function. You destroy your populist movements, you disembowel your traditional liberal establishment, and then, and Dostoevsky wrote about this, it's what Demons is about, it's what Notes from Underground is about. You enter what Dostoevsky calls an age of moral nihilism. The very qualities that are celebrated in corporate America and celebrated on like reality TV shows like Survivor are the qualities of psychopaths. Superficial charm, self-aggrandizement, manipulation, even of your supposed friends, an incapacity for remorse or guilt. And if you win on Survivor, you get fleeting fame and a little money. It's the same disease that fuels the insanity of Goldman Sachs, a criminal enterprise. In the 17th century, speculators were hung. Today, they run the political system and the economy. Speculation is a disease. And there has been absolutely no, the system collapsed, as all speculative enterprises do. And so they loot the U.S. Treasury to begin the game all over again. What happens when it goes down next time? And it is going to go down. It may be going down right now. And I think all of these occupiers on Wall Street who, to their credit, don't look like me. I was down there the other day spending most of the day with a 22-year-old woman by the name of Ketchup. And she's one of the smartest damn people I've ever been with. When you bury yourself inside this movement, you realize the potential that it has and the resilience. These people are not going away. Because one of the things you find when you spend a lot of time down there is that these kids are highly educated. This is a youth-driven move. They're incredibly smart. And they didn't want to become a whore for Citibank or J.P. Morgan. And they got out in the wider world and they realized they'd been had. Huge loans they could never repay. Ketchup runs a theater cooperative in Chicago and to survive as a waitress. She arrived in New York. She had been bounced from a flight, and she had that $200 coupon. It was the only way she could get to New York, with a suitcase that had like a sleeping bag and about $40. And she's still there, and she's not leaving. And neither are any of the other people around her. And I can tell you that the power elite is terrified of them, because they know better than we do how rotten, corrupt, and gamed the system is. And if this message spreads, I mean, they're right, the 99%ers. We live in an oligarchic state where CEOs on Wall Street pull down $900,000 an hour. And this message doesn't get out in universities, generally, because who sits on trustee boards? Half of the people on all these trustee boards should be in prison. What's celebrated, both in terms of college presidents, it's the ability to suck up money from hedge fund managers. That's it. It has nothing to do with education. And any kind of confronting the moral degeneracy within the university setting is a good way to get yourself kicked the hell out of the university setting. And that message is delivered to students. They get it. I've taught at Princeton. They know that's why Goldman Sachs is in there after sophomore year, giving them internships for the summer and sucking them into the financial services industry at $120,000 a year. So I'm very hopeful. It's spreading. These kids are awake. You know, I go down and do protests with Veterans for Peace, a group I love. But, you know, I'm sort of the youngest guy there. And there's a lot of time talking about what it was like in the 60s. And their heart's in the right place, but it's not going to have any traction until it's driven by a new generation. And this is being driven by your generation. And it's driven by your language and your concerns. I just did an interview with McLean's magazine a few minutes before I gave this lecture, and they keep wanting to say, well, what's it like? Is it like the Paris Commune? Is it like flower power? Is it, because they just want labels. I said, it's like what it is. I feel like, what's that line from The Tempest, you know? Oh, no, it's from Anthony and Cleopatra. It's where they're teasing, Anthony's teasing Ina Barbas. What's the crocodile like? Well, it's like it is. It has eyes like it has. You can't, don't reduce this to jingoistic, cliche-ridden, because that's the way they write it off. So I hope there are some of you here who'll go down and join them. It's just a train ride away. It's very inspiring. I know Kayla and others have been there. It's empowering because, just to close, what the corporate state has effectively done to your generation is cut you off from each other through electronic hallucinations. When you're sitting in front of your device or your screen, you're still alone. And that's just where they want you, alone. And where they don't want you is in Liberty Plaza. Because I think, as Kayla will tell you, I think you were there for when 1,000 marchers were on the Brooklyn Bridge. The roar of that crowd walking across that bridge, going, whose bridge? Our bridge. It's a sacred moment. Even if the cops walk in tonight and break it up, bust up that whole park. They're finished. Because that's in the DNA of every single person who was there. And for any of you who have a conscience, f*** your classes. Just go. Any of you... If you don't go now, you will so deeply regret it. And you will come back a changed person and an empowered person because you'll, not in an intellectual way, but in a visceral way, understand that you're not alone. There are people out there like you who care, who have a heart, and who have the courage to fight back. Thank you.
This is the moment for audience interaction and questions. We have a mic right here, so if you have a question you'd like to ask or a comment that turns into a question, please feel free to line up at the mic.
Mel, you brought up the whole issue of Ralph Nader, and usually the argument is if you vote for Ralph Nader, it would be like voting for the opposite side. And so what is your reaction to saying how the system as it exists now has been constructed so that it gives the two options only, and any option for anything else essentially would take you out of the game?
No, the argument is that there is no option.
Well, yeah.
There is no way to vote against the interests of Goldman Sachs. Period.
So, but like, how would you address the overall argument of the either operating are you saying that the only way to address the core issues is by countering the system as it stands currently?
Civil disobedience, it's all we have left.
Right. And within the political system, as it's like, not outside the political system that we currently have, like not outside the Democratic Republic, like all the overall political system that's even not recognized, what kind of, like, is there a way of truly, I guess, acting upon it?
Yeah, go get arrested. That's what I do. I mean, it's not fun. I mean, to steal Wendell Berry's line, going to jail is more time than I care to donate to the U.S. government. But it is all we have left. And all the great moral voices, Wendell Berry, they're all saying it. Wendell, 77 years old, occupied the governor's office in Kentucky against mountaintop removal, which is killing the Appalachian Mountains, the lungs of the eastern United States. And... that's it. We are the last thin line of defense, and who care about an open and a civil society. And if not, we will see all opposition to groups like the Tea Party, which are proto-fascist movements that celebrate the gun culture, violence, bigotry, racism, and do what all fascist movements do, which is target the vulnerable. Undocumented workers, Muslims, intellectuals, homosexuals, such an old damn story. And so either we get out there and fight for the open society, or we become complicit in it being snuffed out.
You spoke about taking a train ride into the city as being an easy thing, but you're not that familiar with Long Island.
I gotta get home tonight.
Long Island Railroad is on the verge of collapse.
So is the New Jersey Transit.
Yep. Right.
So is Amtrak.
So much. Well, I'm just talking for middle class America is suddenly having to wake up to find we had a storm on Long Island. My house didn't have electricity or phone for 6 days. A power company, so-called Long Island Power Authority, that's supposed to provide us with electricity, but it doesn't own a generator on Long Island. It was a corrupt political deal that was put together to circulate a number of friends through as CEOs who never, until very recently, never gave a competitive bid on anything that the company bought. The company doesn't bill its subscribers. The people who buy electricity from the Long Island Power Authority. It's done by this other organization, National Grid, that actually owns the generators, that actually prepares the bills, that actually goes for collection actions. And this is typical of what's on Long Island. We don't know, most of the people on Long Island are so far removed from many of the things you said, because Long Island's only newspaper, Newsday, has a fashion centerfold most of the time. It has almost no international or national news. It's squeezed into one page. It has about five or six pages of celebrity news every day. And are you familiar with your newspaper?
Yeah, I know.
Associated Press.
I knew Newsday when it used to be a good paper.
I still have one or two friends, and they can't believe they still work there. But you know what the Associated Press is.
Yeah. I was a journalist for a
it's
long
a to-
time.
I know. I was just joking. And it spins one story after another, and this is what goes into Newsday.
You're right, the newspapers are all anemic and dying, but the real problem is the rise of cable and the degradation of traditional commercial media, the three networks, so that news becomes, you know, Charlie Sheen's meltdown or Anthony Weiner's, you know, boxer shorts, or, I mean, who knows what's happening now. I can hardly keep up with it. You know, Kendra, I don't even want to know who Kendra is. I don't have a TV.
She's the
but,
president,
I mean, but I go through an airport and this, like, pollution reaches me. I actually know that Kendra had sex in her trailer before dancing on this. I don't want to know this. I don't want to know. It's like, go back and read Cicero. It's the spectacle. It's the tawdry crap of the arena that, to quote Cicero, ends up poisoning the political and civil discourse of Rome. And that's precisely it. I mean, we're killing ourselves. Your railway is just a small example, or the electric grid or anything. We're hollowing ourselves out from the inside by psychopathic criminal forces of which nobody can control, and we are entranced with and that's just disconnected us from reality. And I wrote a book about this called Empire of Illusion, but it's that's what's happened.
I agree with you 100%. What I'm suggesting, and I'll go down, I see a student. We do have to offer students an alternative world.
I just offered them an alternative world. Get on a train and go to...
No, but getting arrested is a way of getting attention and letting more people understand what's going on. But we have to know about worker cooperatives. We have to know about of contracting globalization down to local businesses and local schools and all.
Okay, Wall Street's a good place to start. These people are really conscious of all of that stuff.
In the spring, I was at a demonstration in Union Square. You were there, too. It was against Bank of America for not paying any income taxes. And we protested around the bank, and we actually got into the lobby. And I did want to say that, you know, I felt a lot of satisfaction from doing that. I mean, it was a specific cause. And just one of the things that I would have a cause against Wall Street for is I'd love to go down to the Federal Reserve and demonstrate in front of the Federal Reserve, because they're the ones that really run our monetary policy. That would be one of my...
Well, you know, we're starting an occupation of a plaza on Thursday in Washington. So you can come. Come. We won't be that far from the Federal Reserve.
Hello, thank you for coming. I just have a question. I mean, I have my own opinion about Obama's presidency. To me, he sort of seems like the bare minimum of change in order to keep the system afloat. I'm just wondering what you think about his, you know, policy changes, or if he did anything really worthwhile, because at first I had high hopes, and then shortly came to realize that there was not really much difference besides, you know, maintaining, I guess.
Obama functioned as a brand. In the same way that a few years ago Calvin Klein and Benetton put up on their billboards people of color and HIV-positive models to associate their products with the risque lifestyle and progressive politics. But of course, it was, as with all brands, to make passive consumers confuse a brand with an experience. That is why, after he won election, Advertising Age gave Obama its top annual award, which was Marketer of the Year. He beat Nike, Apple, Zappos, because the professionals know damn well what he did. And that's why he got so much corporate money, $600 million. And he got it from Wall Street. Now Wall Street's turned on him. Why did he get it from Wall Street in 2008? Because Wall Street thought they'd been caught. The meltdown came, they thought they were exposed, and they were scared. Now they're not scared anymore. F*** Obama, we don't need him. Let's get a Neanderthal like Rick Perry.
Yeah, that's what it seems like that way to me as well. Just the newest hand of the same power, just not really...
Don't waste your time, Monica. Go down to Wall Street. You're young.
I've lost hope in politics.
Well, don't lose. Politics is a waste. I mean, traditional politics, it's a carnival act.
Absolutely.
Just forget it. I mean, you know, and one of the reasons I hate MSNBC is because they're always trying to steer you back into the Democratic Party. Yes. And in a way, they become even more disempowering, you know, that because it's a phony left.
Absolutely.
Oh, yeah. We got to do everything we can to get Obama elected. What's this guy, Ed something?
Ed Schultz.
These guys are just ridiculous.
I was there last week, so I'm planning to go back again.
Good for you. That's right.
I was going to talk to you about that, but first, you mentioned something about the social media and how it's kind of becoming a distraction implied by the corporations. What's your stance on, or what's your opinion on social media being active in, like, a lot of the recent revolutions and being involved in Occupy Wall Street?
Look, right now, social media is useful as a form of communication. It's useless as a form of activism. Getting a Facebook page to save the whales doesn't do a damn thing for the whales. It may make you feel good at 2 in the morning in front of the glow of your screen, but it's not activism. All of the organizers of Wall Street get it. They've created their own media so that when Anthony Bologna decides to pepper spray those women, there was no traditional media there, not one. And yet they had it filmed from several angles and it all got up on YouTube and the internet. I did an interview with them a week ago Sunday in the morning. It was a really long interview. It was like 40 minutes. And the last time I checked, 51,000 people had watched it. Now, they have recognized that the traditional systems of communication don't work. These people are courtiers. They're hedonists of power. They define their success as journalists by their access to the powerful and ability to do interviews with powerful or famous people. I can tell you that's not journalism. Katie Couric is not a journalist. She's a celebrity. That's why she makes $15 million a year. It's about that ability to project a false kind of empathy. Clinton did it, that kind of feel your pain language. Meanwhile, he's like ramming NAFTA through, the biggest betrayal of the working class in this country since the Taft-Hartley Act of 1948. He's deregulating the banks. He's destroying welfare. He's deregulating the FCC so Clear Channel can buy every damn radio station in this country. So, I mean, there are so many reasons to go to Wall Street. Well, the media, it's in the center of the park. And they're completely prepared if the police raid it. And they've decided that what they will do is everybody will gather in a circle around that media center to protect it as long as they can so that they can transmit outward what is happening. Because they don't trust the traditional media, and nor should they. So they created their own media. So you talk about social networking, they use it in a way that I think is smart, but they don't pretend that it's activism. They don't think that writing a blog is going to do anything. When they do transmissions on social media, and it's worth reading, look at the Occupy Wall Street website, it's really nuts and bolts. At 1 o'clock, we're going to have a General Assembly be there. Or whatever. And so in that aspect, as a form of communication, it's really good. But I think too often, people within your generation, I'm not picking on you, just everyone else in your generation, they've confused social network as itself a meaningful technology. And ultimately, it's neutral. It's not meaningful. And let me, while I'm here, trash Facebook. Facebook, for me, is part of the whole, it's not about communication, it's about self-presentation. Yep. And it buys into the disease of celebrity culture. Everything you put up on Facebook is designed not to actually communicate anything authentic about you, but the image that you want, even right down to the comments, the image that you want presented. And that's something we've got to break away from.
And again, I trimmed a couple of questions, so there's one or two more on the video itself. As far as Facebook goes, I committed Facebook suicide the other day. I've just gotten tired of it. I regularly delete all my Facebook cookies, because otherwise you're handing a record of your surfing behavior over to the same central authorities that manage Facebook. And because of this activity, I was told that Facebook wanted to know more details. It said there was a risk of breach of security of my account. Now, I typed in a captcha, which I think is fair enough to make sure I wasn't a bot. But then the software demanded that in order to access my account, which was of course always their account, they're building a profile on me, it wanted me to start tagging friends' names to photos, and I just said enough is enough. So I'm going to be looking into a decentralized social software system called Diaspora, which is not as mature as Facebook, doesn't have as large a user base, but I think it has the right ideology that your data is under your control, not their control. Just felt I had to get that off my chest. We continue with a short piece on support for the Occupy movement by the US police force. This is from Russia Today.
Almost 5,000 people have been arrested during Occupy protests across the U.S. so far, but even the police are starting to defect to the other side. Our correspondent Marina Portnaya has been finding out why some people have been choosing to make history instead of making arrests.
Our streets! Our streets!
Occupy Wall Street has become an undeniable American household name. And police crackdowns against the Democratic movement have become something of the norm. Not so normal is seeing one side endorse the other. Retired Philadelphia police captain Ray Lewis became the game changer on November 17th, arrested while demonstrating with Occupy protesters on the streets of New York City. The 24-year veteran was held in police custody for 11 hours and received one comment from a New York cop.
Nobody talked to me. This one individual said that I had the testicles of an elephant.
Although all of America's police force is part of the 99%, Captain Lewis says cops secretly supporting OWS face dire consequences by going public.
A tremendous fear of losing their job, being disciplined, being fired. And then what do they do? Everybody in the 99% has that fear, and police officers also. They cannot risk. They have children, they have wives. What would they do once they're fired? There are no jobs available.
The nighttime raid on Zuccotti Park and subsequent arrest of dozens of journalists covering the story are among many reasons Captain Lewis says he temporarily transplanted to Manhattan.
That's close to a dictatorship. When you exclude the media, that's what dictators around the world do, and that is very scary.
Brutal scare tactics such as pepper spray, batons, and flash grenade canisters have been used against Occupy camps throughout the U.S. Oakland, California resembled something of an urban war zone this fall, leaving a war vet in critical condition and the eyes of an 84-year-old burning from tear gas. Oakland police officer Fred Chavez is the only active cop who's gone on record with his support.
Like I totally agree with Occupy Wall Street, even to an extent with Occupy Oakland. I am a part of the 99%. For the most part, people are peaceful and they want to see change.
Many believe the biggest change could come when or if U.S. law enforcement officials stop suppressing the right to assemble and begin supporting it.
Despite his arrest, Captain Lewis is back at Zuccotti Park showing unwavering support for the Occupy movement. Standing roughly 10 or 15 feet away from him, a group of New York City police officers. Yes, they're here securing the area, but some are beginning to show a little interest.
For the first time, I had an officer break ranks yesterday at the barricade line. A white officer named Officer Murray, and he introduced himself and he started to ask me a few questions. I said, do you know the risk you're taking? And he was so brave that he said, hey, this is still America. And until a supervisor orders me back to the line, I'm going to talk with you. I hope to get mainstream America involved, the police involved, realizing that we're all victims of corporate America and that corporate America has got to be stopped.
Now let's have a music break. This is We Are the Many by Mancana.
Ye come here, gather round the stage. The time has come for us to voice our rage against the ones who've trapped us in a cage to steal from us the value of our wage. From underneath the vestiture of law, the lobbyists at Washington do gnaw at liberty, the bureaucrats guffaw. And until they are purged, we won't withdraw. We'll occupy the streets, we'll occupy the courts, we'll occupy the offices of you till you do the bidding of the many, not the few. Our nation was built upon the right of every person to improve their plight. The laws of this republic they rewrite, and now a few own everything in sight. They own it free of liability. They own that they are not like you and me. Their influence dictates legality. And until they are stopped, we are not free. We'll occupy the streets, we'll occupy the courts, we'll occupy the offices of you till you do the bidding of the many, not the few. You enforce your monopolies with guns while sacrificing our daughters and sons. But certain things belong to everyone. Your thievery has left the people none. So take heed of our notice to redress. We have little to lose, we must confess. Your empty words do leave us unimpressed. A growing number join us in protest. We occupy the streets, we occupy the courts, we occupy the offices of you till you do the bidding of the many, not the few. You can't divide us into sides, and from our gaze you cannot hide. Denial serves to amplify, and our allegiance you can't buy. Our government is not for sale. The banks do not deserve a bail. We will not reward those who fail. We will not move till we prevail. We'll occupy the streets, we'll occupy the courts, we'll occupy the offices of you till you do the bidding of the many, not the few. We'll occupy the streets, we'll occupy the courts, we'll occupy the offices of you till you do the bidding of the many, not the few. We are the many, you are the few.